You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking about the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol insurrection on January 6th. The group is aiming to begin public hearings next month, and a final report from the committee is anticipated in the fall. Just in time for midterm elections, right? We're going to talk about the latest from this committee, including controversial presidential phone logs from January 6th. And while we're on this subject of producing records, we'll discuss Assembly Speaker Robin Voss being held in contempt for not handing over some of his own. We want to hear from you, 800-642-1234. What do you think the outcome of all of this will be? What should it be? 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joining us is Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time. Susan, I'm not hearing you. Are you with us?
I am.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Well, we want to talk about this House Select Committee. Its work has been ongoing since last summer. Remind us of its goal.
The committee was established by the House of Representatives to investigate the events that took place on January 6th.
And what was it initially focused on, and have you seen that focus change?
Well, I would say that initially it was looking at the events of January 6th, looking for different people who were involved in the insurrection, looking to see the role that the president, former President Trump, may or may not have had. It was looking to see whether or not it would encourage criminal prosecutions through the Justice Department. And, the interesting thing is that as it's gotten going, it's uncovered more things that have then led it down different paths. So it's hard to say when a committee like this is established. It's not that the charge is so super specific that where it's necessarily going to lead. So, I mean, the umbrella there is January 6th and the different things that happened. And then as one door opens, another door opens.
Right, right. We've seen the Trump aides, senior staff, now family members, some cooperating before the committee, some refusing, being held in contempt. Are there anyone that has surprised you or stood out to you?
Well, I was interested to see that Jared Kushner, former President Trump's son-in-law, met with the committee virtually yesterday to speak to them about what he knows. And it was interesting. I read Benny Thompson, who is the chair of this House committee, talking about how there was helpful information that was shared and that they appreciated hearing from him and things like that. And I also have read that they are in discussions with Ivanka Trump, former President Trump's daughter. Who, mm-hmm. who also, may in fact meet with them. So I think that's been surprising as far as that goes. It was also interesting to me that former President Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, had originally engaged with the committee and shared some things, text messages and other things. That was the origin of the Ginny Thomas text messages. And so that he shared things and he was cooperating and then he stopped. So it's interesting that some people engaged with the committee and then kind of pulled back. So that's one other thing of note.
Right. And on that note, so he was held in contempt, right? But so far, what is the status of that?
The interesting thing about the contempt when it comes from Congress is that, and you're correct, he was voted, he was held in contempt in December, and there's been others since. Dan Scavino is one name that comes to mind recently. And the issue is that when someone is held in contempt of Congress, there's not necessarily a whole lot that Congress itself can do. And so it often is, it relies on the power of persuasion, let's say, to say, right. Well, look, you've been held in contempt of Congress, and we think that that should be sort of a stain on you, and we'd like you to reconsider participating. And but that obviously hasn't been the case. And I think that what some are hoping is that there would be a more aggressive role for the Justice Department that obviously has a lot more authority as far as its options in this regard.
Right, right. We're speaking with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, about the January 6th Select Committee and its action. So meanwhile, there's this parallel criminal investigation going on at DOJ, and you mentioned that the actual House committee's work is, it feeds into that perhaps, but they, beyond the subpoenas, they cannot... is that where their power ends, the ability to request a subpoena and perhaps public shaming if they don't comply?
Right. And I mean, what they were trying to do is compel testimony and compel the surrender of documents.
Right.
And so that's what they're doing I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so I'm wondering, too, how significant is it that we have this 7-hour block of time during which there were no calls recorded on this official White House record?
I think it's very significant because there is a long history of presidential records being kept. And I know that's kind of a very simplistic way for me to say it, but everyone went to the missing minutes on the Nixon tapes because that's the most notable thing that we can think of. And so the idea that we have this day that was a very active day in the life of the president, and we have this 7-hour gap where there's no phone calls, when in fact we know that people spoke to him, because there are people, for example, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy in the House, who and others who have spoken about talking to President Trump on the phone during this period of time. And so it makes a person wonder, what phone was he using? Were the records just not kept, or was he using burner phones or someone else's phone? I mean, what was going on? I think it's quite significant.
And so what constitutes a presidential record as far as these phone calls go?
Well, logs are kept of everything. Logs are kept of the phone calls. Logs are kept of who enters the White House. Logs are kept of who enters the Oval Office. And all of that, when a president, those all have to be kept, and then they are turned over to the National Archives. And there are very clear rules about how that all goes. I mean, you might recall just not too long ago, there was a controversy about classified documents that were taken back to Mar-a-Lago and not turned in to the archives when President Trump left. And so the archivists at the National Archives take that very seriously. Again, what penalty is there? There's not, for all intents and purposes. But I think that the idea that we had this gap of time where we know that the president was speaking to people, but we have no record of that, suggests that there's a reason why we have no record of that.
Right. We're talking about the work of the House Select Committee investigating the events leading up to and including January 6th, 2021. Our guest is Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Love to hear what you think. 800-642-1234. How does any of this impact how you may vote in the fall? 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about the investigations into what and who was behind the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. We're talking about questions of presidential records and other governmental records and how this might all impact how we all vote and how future generations will look back at this period in our country's history. You can join us, 800-642-1234. Well, Susan, I want to follow up on that question of presidential records. Why are they so important?
I think they're important for a couple of reasons. I think they're important for historical purposes, just in the sense that it's important for historians and others to be able to go back and study what presidents have done. So I think that there's that. I also think that there's the transparency issue. And I think that's the more important reason, I would argue, that we're talking about someone who has been an elected, obviously elected to the highest office in the land. And the idea is that the actions that take place through the presidency, in the White House, needs to be very carefully documented in order to ensure that things that take place are appropriate, to use it in a very simple term.
Yes. Yes, and I want to go to the phones, Susan. We've got Mark on the line that wants to join us. Mark's calling from Kendall. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, when somebody doesn't follow the laws that make our country a democracy, aren't there any penalties or anything like that? Or, you know?
Yeah. What happens? What are the consequences?
Well, I think that's what we were getting to even earlier, with this idea that there's this parallel investigation going on through the Justice Department that a lot of Democrats, I would say, are frustrated is not moving as quickly as they would like. And that's where the potential criminal penalties could come into play on a number of different levels. I just think about the practicality that when you have something like a requirement to keep the records, or President Trump removing documents from the White House, these are the kinds of things that I think were written into policy, into law, with the expectation that they would not be violated. And so there isn't necessarily a lot of precedent for how you would punish someone for something like this, for not appropriately keeping phone records, for example.
Yeah. Well, and this brings up a case close to home here in Wisconsin with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He's just been held in contempt of court for not turning over documents related to the Gabelman investigation into the 2020 election here. And for his part, he says, you know, I deleted the emails. They don't exist. I can't turn up what I don't have. What do you think about that, the judge holding Speaker Voss in contempt?
Well, there are expectations for public officials that there's a maintenance of records, and that we turn those over to the public when they're requested. And so what we've seen is that in the case of the request of Speaker Voss in regard to the documents related to the 2020 election, what the judge has ruled is that there's been a disregard of the order, and therefore she held him in contempt of court and said that he had 14 days to turn over the records, and then there would be a fine of $1,000 per day, and that's the penalty that you know, Mark was asking about penalties. That's the penalty that would be in place for this kind of contempt order if those records are turned over. Now, the fact is that if they don't exist, then the records can't be turned over. However, if there's a public records request, you can, you know, run the analysis on the emails to see what's there and what's not there, and then it's the response. The judge can determine what's appropriate to share and what's not appropriate to share. So, but if the records aren't there, and he's saying the records aren't there, they're not there.
Right. And on those penalties, though, I mean, when you have a sitting elected official that is charged by a judge, who actually pays those penalties?
Well, given from what I've read, that would likely be added to the cost of the investigation itself, particularly given that it's not just Speaker Voss, and it's Speaker Voss in his role as Speaker and the Assembly, you know, and so that would be added to the bill.
For taxpayers, essentially.
Right.
So do you think, what do you, and I've noticed that this is, as you mentioned, this is not a common occurrence to find sitting officials held in contempt of court. Do you think we're in a new era of politics? I mean, do you think this is a trend, a start of a trend, or does this echo Nixon, and is this just history rhyming?
No, I think that it is indicative of the era that we are in, of hyper-partisanship and this country that is so divided in their own camps. And so you don't have the kind of comedy that maybe you had in the past. I mean, I think that what we're seeing with the January 6th investigation, I'm not terribly surprised that members of the former administration are not wanting to participate in a process that they believe is illegitimate. And so that doesn't necessarily surprise me. You know, in the state of Wisconsin, as far as this goes, there's such a strong history of public records and public records disclosure that if there's nothing to show, then nothing damning to show, then I'm a bit surprised that we're seeing such a resistance to share the documents.
Well, and with the January 6th committee, I wonder what you think the ultimate impact of this report will be when they finally reach that point. You know, when we finally get to the point where they've talk to everyone they can. They've got as much data as they can possibly gather from people that will talk to them. You know, then what?
I mean, I think it's going to be an important historical document because they're doing a very thorough job of looking at what happened. And I think a lot of it depends on how much more information they're able to gather while their committee is operating. There's a lot to be said for the idea that the Republicans are really trying to just run out the clock, because there's a hope that the Republicans will win in the November election, and then the committee will, if it isn't already done, will be shut down. And so I don't see that I have a lot of hope for big policy change or even for lots of disclosure more, and also of the criminal side of things, given how slow it's been to this point. But I think that, you know, we should do this just for the sake of doing it, because it's going to provide a lot of good information moving forward.
Yes. And we have a caller joining us now. We have Fawn in Madison on the line. Hello, Fawn.
Hi, Fawn, and hello, Molly. I have a comment, which is that this discussion really makes me more mindful that our elected representatives and officials are, in fact, public servants. And I think they need to be mindful that they are public servants. They're not just leaders. They serve the public. And in that capacity, they have obligations and duties that they need to be mindful of. So to me, that's an important point. And secondly, with regard to the disappearance of records, could it be viewed as theft and prosecuted in that manner? Thank you.
Thanks, Fawn.
To answer the second question, I don't believe it would be interpreted that way. But I agree wholeheartedly with the idea of elected officials are public servants and therefore answerable to the public.
Yeah. And on that note, do you think this will change public opinion? You mentioned we got the midterms coming up and that could change the equation entirely. Is this changing public opinion?
I think that for some people, the more that we learn, the more likely it is for them to say, you know what, this is really more than I can accept. It could be the Ginni Thomas text. It could be the 7 hours of phone records. It could be any number of things. But I think that it's kind of the drip, drip, drip. And so I think that potentially some people's opinions could be changed, but not everyone's.
So what are you watching for next?
I'm watching to see if any of these people who have been intransigent will decide that they're going to participate in the process. And I'm also watching very closely what the Justice Department is doing.
Yes. Yes. Well, that is the time that we have today. Thank you so much, Susan, for being with us.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We talked with her about some of the latest developments in the work of the House Committee investigating January 6th. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after the news, we look at the rise of multi-generational households. The number of people living in multi-generational family households has quadrupled since the 1970s. Nearly a third of people in their late 20s are living at their parents' home or with other family. We'll talk about what it means for our communities. I'm Molly Stentz, and you're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll learn how to make great bagels at home, plus the toppings and spreads to go with them. But first, new data from the Pew Research Center show a big rise in the number of people in the U.S. living in multi-generational households, meaning a home with two parents, their young kids, and perhaps a grandparent. According to Pew, the number of people living in multi-generational homes has quadrupled since the early 1970s, and young men have been a big part of that. Nearly 4 in 10 men in their mid to late 20s are living with older relatives. We're taking a close look at that data and talking about what it tells us about how families and their living situations are changing. We'd love to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Are you living in a multi-generational household, or have you in the past? What'd you like about it? 1-800-642-1234. We have with us Ariel Cooperberg, an associate professor of sociology and women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She's also chair of the Council on Contemporary Families. Ariel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about what's driving this increase in multi-generational households?
There's a number of factors. So on one end of life, people are living longer than they used to. Some of them may have higher rates of disability. We also have people who, if you look at the baby boomer generation, they have one of the highest divorce rates of any generation. So more of them may be aging alone. So they may move in with their children for companionship, for caretaking. On the other end of life, there's many it's getting expensive for young people to move out. It's getting more and more expensive as time goes on. people are taking longer to get a good job and be able to afford to move out. Housing prices, again, are, you know, very high, so it's hard for people to move out. Childcare costs are high, so I think there are some multi-generational houses where grandparents may move in and help their kids take care of their grandkids. So there's a number of forces and kind of social changes. And then I think COVID also made things worse, where a lot of people ended up moving back home in part because of loneliness, in part because of job loss, in part because their job went virtual and, you know, they wanted to move back with their family and they could.
Well, and I'm interested. I noticed that this was more true for young men in their late 20s than it was for women. What do we know about why that is?
Well, first of all, women tend to get married younger than men in general. On average, they get married about 2 years earlier. So one factor that may be going on here is that most people tend to move out of their parents' home when they get married. Other things that may be going on, women are now more educated than men are. So women in their 20s may find it easier to be able to afford to move out in some respects. When you talk about the pay gap between men and women, a lot of that pay gap doesn't begin until women start having children. So when they're in their 20s, you know, before many of them have children, they have higher education. Just getting that education, a lot of people move away from their parents' house for the first time when they go to college. And women are now much more likely to go to college compared to men. So again, a number of factors, but all of these add up together.
Sure. And are there regional differences? Does this hold true across the country?
I mean, I think it's gone up all across the country, but it does depend on region. So for instance, in the Midwest, these rates are a little lower than some other regions of the country. In part, I think, because the Midwest has relatively lower housing costs compared to places like the East Coast and the West Coast, especially in the Northeast, right? Yeah. In part, people get married a little younger in the Midwest. So again, if you're getting married, most people will move out. If you could afford to move out, you're more likely to move out. You know, older people may also be able to afford more independent living places because the general cost of living is very low. Childcare is lower than in other regions of the country. So, and then in general, also, there are differences in terms of immigrants are more likely to live in multi-generation households, and people of color are more likely to live in intergeneration households. And the Midwest has fewer immigrants and people of color compared to some other regions of the country. So these contribute to why it's a little bit lower in the Midwest. But I think across the board, throughout the country, these rates are going up and have been for a while.
So what does this data tell us about the idea of the nuclear family, the traditional two kids? And how prevalent that still is in America?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of having two kids is still a very strong idea in America. When you say the traditional nuclear family, I would question how traditional that is. Because if you look at history, there was only a really brief period in time, really like the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, when it was the norm for people to move out of their parents' house before they got married, for multi-generational households, you know, were kind of at an all-time low. And that was actually a pretty unique period in history. And there were, you know, a few things that made that period pretty unique. So if you look before that, for instance, before World War II, most people lived with their parents until they got married. And the life expectancy was also not very high. You know, 100 years ago, the life expectancy was around 60, right? Less than 70. So there weren't a lot of elderly people necessarily living with their children because they weren't living.
Right. We're living longer.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that's also a factor now, too, where people are living longer and longer. Social Security payments are not very high. You know, people have, you know, there's all sorts of health costs that come up that are not fully covered by government programs. And, you know, people are, you know, want to make sure their parents have good care. My own grandfather moved in with my parents before his death because, you know, my grandmother died and, you know, we realized he couldn't take care of himself. So my parents took care of him for a few years. And I think that's increasingly normal as, you know, people like my grandfather who lived until his late 80s, you know, that's an increasingly common experience.
Sure. And so I wonder why were the 50s then an aberration? What caused the interest or the growth in that idea?
Yeah, there were a few things. So a major thing was World War II. After World War II, the soldiers all came home and millions of young men had access to the GI Bill, which suddenly allowed people to go to college who were never able to go to college before. And about 2 million young men took advantage of the GI Bill and went to college. And, you know, we see this huge increase in men going to college. And part of the GI Bill was they gave a living allowance so that people were able to move out of their parents' home. Then when they moved out of, you know, in general, after World War II, the United States experienced a lot of prosperity. They did very well economically for about a decade and a half after World War II. And so people were able to marry very young. The age of marriage dropped to an all-time low. About half of women were married by age 20, and about half of men were married by age 22. So again, if most, you know, half of people are married by the time they're entering their 20s, or at least half of women, and men aren't that far behind, again, those people are going to move out. And there were now these government programs that many young men had that, you know, not only the GI Bill, not only did it open up access to education, it also gave them help with mortgages.
Right.
So there was that. I think there was also, so before World War II, the United States was in the Great Depression for about a decade. And during the Great Depression, many people were forced to live with their family for much longer than they wanted to. The marriage rate went down very low. Age of marriage went up during that time. And more people, you know, we saw an increase in intergenerational households. So I think, you know, and then World War II happened and people were shipping off. But I think afterwards, there was kind of a backlash where people were like, well, now we could finally get out and have our freedom. So we're going to, you know, the best thing is to be free. You want to put your parents in a nursing home. We have the freedom to do that. We have the money to do that now. And I think part of it was a backlash to that kind of like a couple of decades of people feeling like they didn't have a choice.
We're talking to Arielle Cooperberg. She chairs the Council on Contemporary Families, and she is with us to talk about why multi-generational households are becoming more common in the United States. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. Are we talking about your family? Do you have a parent or relative living with you? Do you live with them? Do you do that for financial reasons, child care, elder care, something else? Give us a call. 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking about the rise of multi-generational households in the U.S. Arielle Cooperberg from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, stay with us. We'd love to hear from you. What does your family look like? What do you love about living that way? Come on, what do you struggle with? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org. Well, Arielle, I want to dig into the research that you've done on college students and recent graduates moving in with their parents. How much did the pandemic affect this trend?
Yeah, so I collected a survey of college students last April. And about 27% of them, so this was at two universities where I've been doing a study for a while, But last year, about 27% said a year into the pandemic, they had moved back with their parents because of the pandemic.
Was that the primary reason?
I mean, we directly asked, like, did he move back home because of the pandemic? And we also, so we also looked at people who lived with their parents for other reasons. And there were a fair amount of people who lived with their parents before the pandemic. Among students, it was about 46% had lived with their family. We asked, where did you live in February 2020? During, as a result of the pandemic, this number went up to 62%. So there was, you know, definitely living, the pandemic was not the only reason that people live with their parents in young adulthood. We also found in research that was kind of prior to the pandemic that people are more likely to move back home with their parents after they graduate college. So over half of college graduates in our study move back home within the first year and a half after graduation.
So do you expect that would change as the pandemic lessens, dare I say?
Yeah, I think to some extent. So one thing we found last year was there was a big drop compared to previous surveys that were prior to the pandemic in terms of the graduating seniors in college who said they had a job lined up for after graduation. So I think one, you know, one reason we may see these trends of people moving back home during the pandemic is job loss, or there weren't job opportunities. They were, well, now we're in an opportunity, you know, we're kind of in the reverse situation where some places are having problems hiring, wages are going up. So that could mean some reversal in this trend. But in the long run, I think, you know, it's still going to be higher than it was 20 years ago. But I think there, you know, there was definitely a bump up during the pandemic that hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, this pandemic is soon going to be coming to an end and things will be reversing themselves.
And what do you think the impact of this will be on our housing market, say?
I think one thing we're seeing kind of play out already is that more people are living with their parents for longer, which means parents who previously would have been retiring and downsizing to smaller houses are now staying in those houses. So one of the reasons, you know, people talk about investors is the reason the housing market is so tight right now, for people trying to move into houses, right? But part of that is people not selling their house because their kids still need that extra bedroom because now they're living at home until they're 28 or 30. So I think it's contributing to this tightening of houses. I think on the other end, as more people are kind of having these multi-generational families with their parents, you may see interest in different types of housing that has, you know, they call them mother-in-law apartments, like
right.
A place in your house that's a little kind of set off from the rest of the house so people could have their privacy but could also easily reach each other. So I think those might become more popular. And then if fewer young adults are leaving their home, there's also the housing market of the rental market of people selling, you know, renting to college age students and 20 somethings. It's kind of, you know, like rundown apartments we all had in our 20s.
Yeah.
So those, you know, maybe those will become less competitive.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this trend will continue, if it will start to drive changes in the way our cities look and the way, like you said, zoning has to change to allow for the density required to have space for people living together. But I wonder if this trend is, I mean, it's been happening since the 70s, right? So beyond the pandemic, is this enough to structurally drive changes, or is it too soon?
I think it will eventually. I think we're also going to see things like, because of the pandemic, there was a huge push to embrace online technology. So I think a lot of online courses were developed. There may be more options for distance learning which may also drive more people to stay home. I think there's been a public conversation about student debt. That's one thing I study is student debt.
Sure.
And there's been a big public conversation about that over the past few years, which I think maybe has made some people question taking out student loans to move away to college, for instance. So I think all these trends are going to continue to, you know, maybe it'll go down a little bit after the pandemic, but in the long run, I think we're going to continue to see an increase in intergenerational households, unless we see major social change, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you can never tell what happens in the future,
sure.
right? No one could have predicted sure. COVID and all the changes it would make. And I don't think any of us really knows how many of these changes are going to be permanent and how many, you know, will go back to the way things were.
Yeah.
So we'll find out in the next few years, I guess.
And I wonder what you found in your research when you were talking to young people about how the experience of having to live with their families or with their parents, how it kind of changed their perception of adulthood.
Yeah. So many people expect that, you know, you graduate college and then you're going to go off and become an adult and be independent. So moving back home, often for financial reasons in our study, to save money, you know, we focus on people who had student loan debt. So a lot of them were paying off their student loan debt, felt to many people in our study who we interviewed, like they weren't a grown up, right? Like they couldn't be fully adults because they're still living with their parents. And some of them kind of had strategies to feel more like an adult. So some of them, and this is a study I did with my co-author, Joni Mazzellis, who did all these actual interviews. I do more of the survey stuff.
Sure.
But some of them had strategies like they would pay their parents $50 a month or $100 a month and kind of felt like, oh, now it's an equal partnership because I'm paying rent. Some of them paid more. Some of them were giving like $500 a month to their parents.
Interesting.
They would give back help in other ways. But then that led some of them to feel like it was kind of a burden. You know, some of them, one person was helping out with her younger siblings and was basically doing full-time childcare for them while her parents were working. And she felt like that was kind of burdensome, but that she had to do it because she was living with her parents for free. But, you know, a lot of people felt there was a lot of benefits to it. And we had people in our study who just in 3 years after graduation were able to pay off student loan debt. We had people who were able to save up for a down payment and bought a house within 3 years after graduating. And, you know, a lot of people said their parents were happy to help them out and they wanted them to live with them so that they could save that money. So, you know, there were benefits and drawbacks, I think.
Well, we've got just a minute left, but we have a caller on the line. I'll go next to Sun Prairie, where we've got Steve on the line. Good afternoon, Steve. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm just a little confused by the guest comment. You know, compared to 20 years ago, when we had a lot of baby boomers still in the prime of their career, things have dramatically changed. We've been talking about for 25 years now in manufacturing that we're going to have so many open positions because the baby boomer is retiring.
Okay.
Even in the accounting world, there's not enough accountants that are graduating.
Sure, Steve, we got just
position.
A minute left. I'm so sorry to cut you off, but I'd want to hear Ariel's response to the question of jobs being prevalent and available now.
Yeah, I think you're right. So jobs are available now, but they also don't have the benefits or pay that jobs used to have, right? So that's another reason people are staying with their parents for longer. You're definitely right.
All right. Well, I think we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We have been speaking with Ariel Cooperberg. She is a sociologist with the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She was talking with us today about the growing number of multigenerational households in the United States and what that tells us about how our families and how our communities are changing. Coming up after the news, we're taking your breakfast to New York with a cookbook on how to make bagels, schmear, lox at home. I'm Molly Stentz, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.